Please report, my name's Bill Pritchard and I represent First City Bank. Let me first tell briefly what the facts were in this case.
Counsel, are you going to be the sole one?
No, Your Honor, Mr. Kent, who is filed on Ampersuri.
You asked for consent to do this, but have you advised the marshal as to how much time you need?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Mr. Gex and Mr. Marock borrowed money jointly from the petitioner to finance a boat. The boat was registered in both names. Later, they apparently had some disagreement and between themselves and entered into a mutual agreement whereby Mr. Gex would make the required payments, and upon doing so, the boat would belong to him. Later, Mr. Gex defaulted on this note, and after the bank had sent him to and allowed this thing to be in default for 2 months, they'd been sending him late notices, which he acknowledged he received, had not been paid. At that point, the bank officer contacted Mr. Marott, the co-maker, called upon him to make payment. At that particular time, he was living with a lady by the name of Capri Allen, which she testified she considered to be a common law marriage. When the bank called upon Mr. Marott to make this payment, she wrote out a check to the bank, gave it to Mr. Marott, he delivered it to the bank, and the bank officer released the boat to Mr. Marott. 3 days later, she got into the bank, and by this time, Mr. Marott had decided he wanted the title to be transferred in the boat to Ms. Capri Allen. The bank officer made a mistake in not actually notifying Mr. Gex of the intended disposition, and the same day that she went out to sign the note and so forth, Mr. Gex came in and paid the note off. At which time he got the title certificate that had not been transferred by the bank, and she was notified that the whole thing had been nullified because of the fact that Mr. Gex had paid the note. She never made any payments to the bank. She never tendered any payments to it.
I'm
sorry.
What happened physically to the boat during this period of time?
The 3 days, the very first day when he brought the payments up to date and paid the repossession fee, the boat was turned over to Mr. Marott. He testified he got it.
Did the bank ever have physical control of that boat after
No.
You say the boat was turned over to Mr. Marott. At page 4 of the Court of Appeals opinion, there is language here that Ham, from the bank, or it says the bank officer informed, you say Gex, is it Gee or Gree or something?
He pronounces it Gex.
All right. It says the bank officer informed Gex that he could get his boat from Capri. Now that's what the Court of Appeals opinion says at page 4, and again at page 11, Court of Appeals opinion states, however, Caprillion testified that after tender of the amount in default on June 16th, the bank delivered the boat to her.
Now, that was a disputed fact. Let me say that Mr. Marock was the one I had reference to. He testified, and it's undisputed in that regard, that the boat was turned over to him that day, the 16th, on the 19th when she went there.
How could it be undisputed
You've
got evidence in the record that the bank gave the boat to her?
Well, I'm sorry. I should have said he never retracted it or anything. It was a fact question. And, of course, the jury was not asked that particular question. They were asked about a disposition. And the argument here is whether or not a disposition actually occurred behind in the code.
What is special issue number 9 here?
Your Honor, I confess I don't have that with me. I'm sorry.
Well, where was this boat physically located all this time?
A repossession officer had it, Your Honor. He had taken it over, and it was held by a repossession officer. I do not know. I mean, in other words, it was some service, I should say, not an officer of court or anything. State.
It had been repossessed, whatever, it was still in that person's possession.
It had not been sequestrated. It had been, they used a repossession service, which simply went out and found it.
So the bank gave whoever had physical control of the boat instructions to deliver it either to Marotti or Capri Ellen.
The testimony was that he called the repossession man and told him to release it to Mr. Marotte. Marotte said that he picked it up and took it over to the house. She was at work at that particular time, I believe. Then, following this, as I say, the bank endorsed the title certificate over to Mr. Gex, and I think that's what the court appeals had reference to, and informed him that Mr. Marotte had the boat. Based on this particular set of facts, the court proceeded to hold that this was a disposition under the code. We've had a series of points, beginning with our first point, to the effect that the court, trial court erred in awarding statutory damages. There was no issue dealing with actual damages in this case. They allowed them $1,877.65 as statutory damages, and we contend that that was not in compliance with the code.
Are you saying there has to be an award of actual damage, an actual loss found by the jury before there can be statutory damages?
There is a case to that effect, Your Honor.
Not a Texas case.
Sir, yes, sir. My understanding, I cited in here to the effect that there must be proof of some actual damage.
Was that the Johnny Tennessee case?
Perhaps so. Let me see.
No, it's a Jimmy Green.
Yeah, Jimmy Green.
Versus
yes.
Johnny Tennessee.
Yes, sir. That's right. You're
in
right.
In that case, the property had never been turned over, had it? That's a little bit different on the property.
It is. I have to agree. The facts are slightly different, but I think, Your Honor, the essence of it was the only real transaction here that occurred was between Ms. Capra Allen and the bank officer, and Mr. Gex wants to rely upon that set of facts as establishing his cause of action. And I'm submitted that if anybody had a claim, perhaps it was Ms. Capra Allen, who's no longer in the case. And so she has no claim that she's asserting, and consequently he can't rely upon what transpired outside his presence, which he was not a party to. I have cited to the court the section of the code 9.507A to the effect that if the code says if a disposition has occurred, then the debtor, in violation of the code, then the debtor has a right to recover any loss that he sustains as a result of failure to comply with this chapter. And of course, this is a new statute to the law of Texas at that particular time. It's unknown to the common law, and so it's our contention that we rely upon this court's decision in Dutch versus Owens to the effect that statute must be strictly construed. One of the provisions in the statute goes on and provides that speaks about the collateral being disposed of, and it's our contention that this has an obvious meaning of a transfer of title insofar as a boat which has title certificates. Another section, 9.504E, provides that a disposition to the co-maker is not a violation of the code, as that term is not a sale, they say. of the, or disposition of the collateral under this chapter. So if for no other reason, since it was turned over to Mr. Murat, it's our contention that the petitioner did nothing more than release it to the co-maker, consequently that the court was in error in granting a judgment for any damages against the bank in this area. The next set of points deals with the matter of attorney's fees. And this, I think, is the law is much clearer on perhaps than it was on the first set of points. Mr. Gex made no pleading, no proof, no issues submitted on the question of whether he presented any kind of contract claim to the petitioner. He had no proof of any actual damages in this case. And the for the first time after the trial of the case, he filed a motion to modify the trial court's judgment where he contended that this award of attorney's fees was proper under 9.507. At that point, the court granted, upheld the award of attorney's fees in the trial court and the court of appeals and in this court. It's our contention that, again, that attorney's fees is something that has to be strictly construed. The statute, there was no evidence of any contract between the parties in this case for attorney's fees. It certainly wasn't authorized under Article 2220. This court has held the requirements of presentment and so forth, which had to be done in the Ellis versus Walter case. This court held that he must plead and prove the presentment of the contract claim and that the other party failed to tender performance. There's no proof in this case of that. The matter of attorney's fees under the UCC section, the court upheld that, saying that the that section of 9.507A that made reference to the recovery of any loss, that this included attorney's fees. No mention of attorney's fees in that particular section of the code. It's our contention that the court did not strictly construe that statute and consequently has violated the settled law on this subject of strictly construing such statutes. I've agreed to give Mr. Kent the remainder of my time and
You turn it over to Mr. Kent, Mr. Pritchard, yes. Mr. Kent in his amicus brief indicates that he is not going to speak to the disposition issue, so let me talk to you on the disposition. Is it your position that because the boat was turned over to Murat, or assuming it was turned over to Murat, that the provisions of 9.504E apply, and therefore there has been no disposition contrary to the UCC?
That's one element of my argument, yes, sir.
All right. And you're just saying as a matter of law, there can be no disposition, assuming the boat was turned over to Ms. Caprillion. Are you saying as a matter of law that is not a disposition to her?
Your Honor, I'm saying that as the term disposition is referred to in the Business and Commerce Code, it has reference to an actual transfer of title.
But what does this language in 9.504A mean when it says sell, lease, or otherwise dispose? What's that otherwise dispose mean?
I confess I don't have any authority on the subject, Your Honor. This I think Mr. Kent perhaps deals with this somewhat, but with some treatises, but I don't know of any cases exactly in point on this other than the Court of Appeals case here. But it seems to me that if you had a lease, for instance, or some change of ownership, whether in a lot of instances, of course, there is no transfer of title certificate because there's no title certificate, but here we have one. And there was no evidence of any attempt to lease it or anything like that. It was simply turned over to the coal miner.
Are you saying, though, it's your contention that for a disposition to occur, there must be transfer of title?
In this particular case, yes, sir. Because this comes under the provisions of the section of the law, you know, dealing with the water code, which says the only way you can transfer title to one is by transferring the title itself, and the title had never been touched. All right, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is David Kent. I'm with the law firm of Hughes and Hill in Dallas. I appreciate the opportunity to speak as an amicus curiae under the new rules 498 as amended back in April. I represent Kensington Mortgage and Finance Corporation, which is a business nationwide that has operations in Texas primarily concerned with the financing of mobile homes to consumers. As such, Kensington is a secured creditor and regularly deals in these problems of defaults, repossessions, and resales of collateral. Because of Kensington is very concerned about the potential ramifications that this particular case has for all secured creditors and for the potential liability it may impose on secured creditors, Kensington felt it appropriate to file an amicus curiae brief. There are three issues primarily involved in this case. The first issue is, did a disposition occur? That is the issue that Mr. Pritchard has addressed. I do have serious reservations about some of the language used by the Court of Appeals in discussing the meaning of a disposition. However, I think that the issues involved in this case really relate to a very unique factual situation where the bank got caught in the middle with a dispute between two co-owners of the collateral. I think the dissenting opinion by Justice Carver in the Court of Appeals highlights the problems that existed in that situation. Because of that, I don't think it is necessarily appropriate for Kensington to address that part of the case because it is really a factual problem there as opposed to a broader problem, even with some of the language in the Court of Appeals opinion. Nevertheless, I would like to address Justice Kilgarland's question as to what is the meaning of a disposition, the phrase otherwise dispose of. I can think of several ways that other dispositions occur in the mobile home industry. One common way is by an assumption of a loan. After a mobile home is repossessed and is held for resale, there are different things that can be done to it. One thing that can be done is an outright sale for cash or for a new loan where the new purchaser comes up and executes a brand new, well, he refinances is what he does, and he goes on a new note himself at a new interest rate different from that the original debtor was on. And that is a sale. Then in the normal course of business, there are frequently people who cannot refinance or do not want to refinance, and instead they will assume the loan at the original interest rate, and they just sign a new assumption agreement. And when they do that, there is not really a sale, as that term is used, at least in the practice of my client, and they have a particular form called a notice of intended disposition, which is different from notice of private sale. So from that perspective, you can consider that and other disposition.
Would you agree with Mr. Pritchard that for there to be a disposition, there must be a transfer of title?
I would not agree with that in the broader sense of what I am discussing, because as I was about to say, another way that there can be a disposition would be to scrap the collateral, to scrap it for salvage value. Now, in the Tannenbaum case, of course, that happened, and this court held that was in effect accepting the collateral in satisfaction of the debt. And that's one way to look at it. But from a secured creditor's point of view, maybe he just looks at it as a scrapping for salvage value, and he'd consider that an other disposition. There can be gifts, There can be a variety of permanent transfers, and I think the key to the determination of what is a disposition must be the permanence of the transfer. That's the real key, at least as far as I'm concerned, because there are many temporary terms of possession, and I address this in a footnote in my amicus brief. There can be many temporary transfers of possession that do not require the advance notice to the debtor. In the case of mobile homes, and I'll speak from our experience, when the mobile home is repossessed, it may be put on a salesman's lot, it may be kept on the mobile home park lot, it may be moved around several places while a new buyer is sought to be found. It may be leased for a period of time. And ultimately, the permanent disposition takes place when there's going to be a determination of the debtor's ultimate debt, because there's finally been a sale or disposition of the collateral. At that point, you have to give the debtor notice, because he's got to have a right to come in and protect himself to see that there will be adequate value for the final disposition of the collateral. But until you reach that point of a final disposition, a permanent transfer, an ultimate end, then you don't have to have notice. And in fact, the code itself makes some reference to that. 9504A allows a secured creditor to sell, lease, or otherwise dispose, so it includes a lease, a temporary act, but the provision only refers to a sale or other disposition. It doesn't even include a lease. And the reason for that, I think, is because that's a temporary disposition. You don't have to protect the debtor's interest there because you're not having a final determination of the debtor's liability on notice.
Permanent means forever. I think the facts in this case are, however, that the boat remained in the possession of either Mr. Marat or Ms. Caprillion for some 14 months. That's more than just temporary.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why I say Kensington really doesn't want to get into that fight, because it really deals with the facts of this case and not the broader perspective. But I did want to take the moment to address your concern about the meaning of the word otherwise dispose of, because that will have an effect on how other secured creditors are treated around the state.
How about situations concerning collateral which are covered by specific title?
Conceptually, I don't see too much of a difference. Mobile homes are covered by certificates of title. They're treated just like boats. And so we run into the same problem that the bank runs into in terms of documenting a transfer of title. You have to do it by a certificate of title, and that's the way you evidence ownership. But in terms of 9504, I think the real key is the permanence of the intended disposition as opposed to a temporary transfer of possession. And that's what caught my attention in the Court of Appeals opinion, was that their phrase, transfer of possession. Any transfer of possession is a disposition, is what the Court of Appeals said, and that's just wrong as far as we're concerned, because there can be many transfers of possession that are not permanent, that are intended to transfer the ownership interest, and they just aren't subject to the notice provision, and they should not be. It just doesn't serve the same function. It would put too much of a burden on secured creditors in many situations to notify a debtor every time they move that collateral, regardless of what the purpose of the move was. That's exactly right, Judge. You don't notify the debtor, we're going to move the collateral over to a fenced lot, but we're not going to sell it, we're just moving it. It doesn't make any difference to the debtor then, because he's not there to protect his interest. Nothing's being sold. No final determination of his rights is taking place there.
Of course, as I know the facts here, it was the intention of the bank to turn it over to Ms. Caprillion. Paperwork was in the mill, and then Mr. Geck shows up at the bank, and at which time they initially refused to take his money, and then when he brings his lawyer back, they couldn't then cancel the paperwork for Caprillion. But in the meantime, while the paperwork is being drawn up, the boat has been turned over to either Caprillion or Marat. Is that those the facts roughly in the case?
It's my understanding of the facts, Judge, gleaned from the Court of Appeals opinion. I really think Mr. Pritchard is more suited to discuss those than I, for he tried the case, and I'm not, as I want to say again, I'm not really trying to get into that part of the case.
Let me ask you a question that you're going to get into. Mr. Pritchard says that there can be no staggered damages without a loss. Is that your position?
That is not my the position of Kensington. I don't think that the statute necessarily reads that restrictively. It guarantees a minimum recovery to the debtor in the event that losses do not reach that minimum. I can certainly see a reason why you'd want to have a loss before you impose a statutory penalty on someone. The purpose of the penalty is to guarantee a meaningful recovery. And if there is no loss, then why should you give someone a windfall? And that's what it amounts to for the plaintiff. If you don't have a loss, it's a windfall.
In 507A, those speak of two things. One, either damages for loss, or two, minimal damages.
Well, it speaks of minimal damages. It says a minimum recovery.
Minimum recovery.
Of the statutory computation.
And in the opinion of the Court of Appeals at page 14, doesn't the Court of Appeals say we're going to award debts the latter recovery? Isn't that their language? But they say there are two types of recovery. It is undisputed that the collateral consists of consumer goods, since proof of economic loss, which is required for compensatory damages, is not required by the statute in order to recover statutory damages. We hold that GEX is entitled to recover the latter. So as to that, there was no double recovery. Your argument on double recovery is the attorney's fees proposition.
Well, that is true, Judge. It is a double recovery, though, because the court says that attorney's fees constitute any loss of actual damage. That's what the Court of Appeals later on says, that the attorney's fees constitute the actual damages that are any loss. We will therefore give Mr. Gex both his attorney's fees under the any loss provision and the statutory penalty of $1,800. So they do have a double recovery. They don't get to the attorney's fees until they say that qualifies as a loss, as actual damages, and we're going to give him both. I would note that the Court of Appeals alternatively held that under Article 2236, Mr. Gex was entitled to attorney's fees. And if that was the sole basis of their holding, I wouldn't have any argument with that in terms of the broad policy that I, as an amicus, argue to the court. But when they say that we're going to put attorney's fees into any loss and then tack that on to the statutory penalty, they've gone too far. They've construed the statute in a way that is contrary to this court's well-established policy of strictly construing any statute concerning attorney's fees. They've read into the statute something that is not there by inserting attorney's fees. And if I may, I'd refer the court to the way that the code is set up itself. The UCC specifically refers to attorney's fees in various points in order to protect the interest of people. Back in Chapter 3, which deals with bills and notes, there is a provision for, in terms of overdue drafts, to determine the sum certain that is due. That is defined under 3106 as including attorney's fees. And if you look in Chapter 9 itself of the UCC, you'll find right on these provisions concerning default that there are provisions for attorney's fees. On this point, though, it's for the creditor's benefit. In 9504, it says that upon resale of collateral, of the debt, the secured creditor is entitled to deduct his expenses of sale, which include attorney's fees. It also says that when under 9506, the redemption provision, when the debtor comes back to redeem his collateral, he has to pay the expenses, including attorney's fees, to the creditor. Now, if the drafters of the code intended to provide recovery of attorney's fees for the debtor under 9507, they certainly would have said so, because they were very explicit at other parts of the code to include provisions for attorney's fees. The Court of Appeals here was motivated by a well-meaning concern, undoubtedly, that the attorney's fees exceeded the amount of recovery that would exist here. But that type of concern does not justify engrafting onto the statute something that does not exist. As I believe I point out in my brief, there are some surveys which have shown there are over 100 statutes in the state of Texas specifically providing for attorney's fees in one way or another. So the legislature has seen fit to provide for attorney's fees where the common law does not. And in this case, the legislature has not provided for attorney's fees, so the court should not, through the means of judicial legislation, engraft that in to this provision of the code. And that's exactly what it would be if the Court of Appeals was affirmed on this point, just the means of judicial legislation to affect some social purpose that they believe is important, which the legislature has not seen fit to act upon. The code, of course, was drafted over a long period of time. After careful thought, it's been revised and amended in Texas several times. Nationwide, it's been amended, and no one has given attorney's fees under these circumstances. Appreciate the opportunity to speak before the court.
We will hear arguments from the other side.
May it please the court, Mr. Glassman will present arguments from the side.
Thank you very much. I please the court, I'm Alan Glassman from Dallas, Texas, appearing on behalf of the respondent Andre Gicks, who's also here today. I would just like to briefly respond to some of the factual statements made by Mr. Pritchard. I would call the court's attention to the jury's finding of special issue number 2, as well as special issue number 9. Special issue number 2 was, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence, was the boat delivered to Mary Ann Caprillion? The jury answered affirmatively. And issue number 9 was, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence, did the bank dispose of the collateral to Mary Ann Caprillion? That was answered affirmatively. All the dealings that the bank had from the point that the boat was in their possession on June 16th were with Mary Ann Caprillion. Jack Marat, the co-maker of the owner, was there. Mr. Hamm, who was the bank's witness, testified that Mary Ann Caprillion made out the check for the $500 for the past two payments and the repossession fees in his office. She lived at the address where the boat was delivered to. She testified that she felt the bank was delivering the boat to her. The issues were supported by evidence. I would also call the court's attention to the fact that the bank, despite the fact that they gave back the promissory note which Mary Ann Caprillion had executed in the various other documents, never gave her back for $500. And so they did receive consideration for the boat. As a brief overview, I'd like to address the case of Tannenbaum versus Economics Lab, which this court decided in 1982, an opinion by Justice Wallace, concerning the purpose of 9504. And Justice Wallace stated that the purpose was to give the creditor as wide a latitude as possible in disposing of collateral, with only two limits. One, that the disposition must be commercially reasonable, and two, you've got to give notice to the debtor unless the debtor renounces notice. Without holding creditors to this minimum, there's much room for abuse, as the court pointed out in that case. Now, the problem with using that case as precedent here and virtually all the other cases decided under 9504 and 9507 have to deal with a creditor disposing of the collateral without giving notice and then seeking a deficiency judgment against the debtor. This case came up in a different posture. It's unique. There's not much jurisprudence on it here or in any other state. There's little guidance available as far as what proper remedy is in this case. Be that as it may, the first issue raised by the petitioner is, can there be a disposition without transfer of title? And based on these facts, I believe they can. The bank took her money, Ms. Caprillion's money, they never returned it. They took a note, which at that point is also consideration, though it's non-cash. It certainly is consideration, and though they quote-unquote canceled it 2 days later, at the time they took the note, well, they had previously given her the boat a few days earlier, that was consideration, and they delivered the boat to her, which the jury answered in special issue number 2.
Incidentally, where in the statement of facts, if you're knowledgeable of, is the support for the Court of Appeals statements on pages 4 and page 11 of their opinion? One, that the bank officer thought he had told your client that he could get the boat back from Caprillion, and two, Caprillion's testimony that the boat had been delivered to her.
I'm not sure if the statement of facts, I'm not sure if Mr. Hamm did in fact testify that he could get the boat back from Caprillion. He testified that they didn't have the boat, that it was delivered. I don't recall exactly if he said he could get the boat back from Caprillion. The second statement, which, if you repeat that again?
Well, page 4, bank officer informed Gex that he could get his boat from Caprillion. You say that that may not be in the record?
I don't recall at this time.
On page 11 of the opinion, Caprillion testified that after tender of the amount in default, the bank delivered the boat to her. Now, is that in the record?
That, I believe, is in the record. I can't give you a citation this time, but I'm certain that is in the record. When the case originally started, Marat was asserting the position that, you know, he was the one that the bank was dealing with. And if, in fact, the bank truly delivered the boat to Marat, there was no disposition. I'll agree with counsel on the other side. He was a co-maker. He'd be entitled to pick up the payments. As the trial developed, Marat took the position that no, it was Caprillion who they were dealing with. Marat conceded in his testimony that he never did anything. He never gave any money to the bank. He simply was carrying, he was carrying instructions from Floyd Hamm to release the boat, and Mr. Marat would tell him where to deliver the boat. I will concede he happened to be living with Ms. Caprillion. There's no Ms. Caprillion that she thought they were married, but I don't, there's no evidence of a common law marriage in the record. Again, all the evidence does point, and the jury did find, that it was Caprillion to whom the boat was delivered to. There is no definition of disposition in the code. We know that it's a couple, we know a couple things that disposition is not. It is not transfer to a surety or a co-maker. It is not transfer to a bank agent. When you were talking with Mr. Kent says, well, if the bank moved the collateral to a storage yard, they certainly would not have to give notice of a disposition because it's not a disposition. I agree with that 100%. But in this case, the bank went far beyond that. The boat was at a storage yard, and they delivered it from there to Ms. Caprillion's residence. As to the jury instructions on disposition, the instruction is not perfect. I think it's, the instruction said you will find that the bank disposed of the collateral if they intended to give it to the party for a time or permanently. Had I had it to do over again, I wish I would have deleted the phrase for a time.
But was that instruction objected to?
That instruction was not objected to, nor was an alternate instruction tendered. And under Rule 279, I think that that issue's is not an issue at this point. The court earlier raised the issue of the, I think it's the Johnny Tennessee case. In the Johnny Tennessee case, no notice was given of disposition, but before it was disposed of, the attorney for the debtor called the car lot and said, please don't sell the collateral, dispose of the collateral. And the car lot didn't. So hence, no disposition took place. In our case, the disposition did take place. So I think to cite that case, to say that, well, without a showing of a damages, you cannot recover the statutory minimum, that's not what that case stands for. That case stands for the proposition, you don't get into the damages unless there's been a disposition. And there was a disposition in this case. Can you recover the statutory damages without a showing of actual damages? Under the language of 9507, I think it's explicit. I would call the court's attention to two cases, not in this state. It's one from a bankruptcy court in the Western District of Michigan, also N. Ray Crandall, 28 UCC Report Service 953. It's a 1980 case. Another case of Allard versus Ford Motor Credit, which is cited by the amicus in his brief, 422 Atlantic 2nd 940. It's a 1980 case out of Vermont. Both hold that you do not need a showing of actual damages. However, in this case, I think there was actual damages shown by the fact that Mr. Marat is undisputed, was without possession of that boat for 14 months. For approximately 3 months, it was in the possession of Caprillion. For the remainder of the time, it was in the constructive possession of the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, pursuant to a writ of sequestration. There is no testimony in the record of what is the daily rental value of the boat, but in fact, There's undisputed that he did not have use of that boat, and I think that is a showing of damages. With whether you have to have the showing of damages or don't need the showing of damages, I think you can recover the statutory minimum in either respect. The second part of the major issue is the question of attorney's fees, whether they're recoverable under 9507A and whether they're recoverable under 2226. The main objection of the amicus is that a recovery under 9507A is a cumulative recovery. In preparing this argument, this was the most troublesome area of all. There is no cases that say attorney's fees are authorized under this section. There are no cases which say attorney's fees are not authorized under this section. We're left with the language of the section that says you are entitled to recover for any loss. The attorney's fees incurred by Mr. Gex, amicus would have you believe that these were elective attorney's fees. He was really trying to resolve a problem with Mr. Marat. This was not his dispute with the bank. However, you get back to the fact that it was the bank's acknowledged mistake that triggered the whole problem. It was the bank that put the boat in the possession of a lady who had paid some money to the bank, and she obviously did not want to give the boat back. She had parted with her money. And the attorney's fees incurred, which started out as a trying to recover the boat, it started out as a lawsuit against Mr. Marat and Ms. Caprillion. The bank was later added a few months later. These were losses occasioned by the actions of the bank.
Well, if you deal with it as a loss, then are you contending that you're entitled to collect your loss and then also collect statutory damages?
It's troublesome, and as a rule of law, I would not want the court to say as a matter of law you can accumulate these remedies. Under the facts of this case, I think you can. Amicus in his brief pointed out, take for example, I think he said the situation where you have the disposition without notice and the creditor then sues for a deficiency. Well, if you accumulate the remedies, number one, the creditor would lose his deficiency judgment. Number two, if it's consumer goods, he could get socked for the statutory damages. Number three, he could get socked for attorney's fees. I have trouble giving the debtor relief from the deficiency and the statutory damages. That bothers me. I think that is a double recovery. Attorney's fees are a little different. There was no deficiency here. The attorney's fees were something that Mr. Gex had to incur in order to attempt to make himself whole, which is to get the boat back, which by this time he has fully paid for. And I don't think attorney's fees to me strike me as just a little bit different than a deficiency. I don't think that is a double recovery.
Are you abandoning, in effect, attorney's fees under 2226?
No, sir. I think they can recover under either.
Well, was there a demand made and no performance satisfied 2226 requirement?
Okay, I think the issue of presentment is, again, a tricky issue. I'll turn to that now.
Well, you say on page 14 of your brief, quote, or page 11 of your brief, the claim under 2226 was pled and proved. Could you show me where in the statement of facts there is any proof that could satisfy the requirements of Ellis versus Waldrop for presentment?
Okay. In my opinion, in this case, the presentment occurred when Mr. Gex and I walked into the bank with the money and said, here's the money, there's the boat. What the bank is being charged with as far as wrongdoing is not refusing to give him the boat. What the bank did wrong was not give notice. Once the money is paid to the bank, the boat is gone. You cannot write a letter to the bank and say, now give me notice of what you intend to do with the boat. It had already been done. The court has held many times that presentment doesn't necessarily have to be in the form of a written demand letter. There are many forms of presentment. I will concede that this is perhaps a little thin, but I think that for what the manner in which the bank reached the contract, this is the only way we could have made a presentment. The breach had already occurred. There's nothing the bank can do to give Mr. Gex notice after they had already disposed of the boat. If the bank is allowed to escape from attorney's fees because they worked so fast they managed to dispose of the boat and no notice was given, then I think that's a windfall for the bank. They did wrong. They are going to be let off the hook because we could not get in there on the actual day they repossessed the boat in an hour before Mr. Pruden got in there with the money. And I think that's wrong. I think this does constitute a presentment in this particular case. There is no jury issue on whether a presentment was made and whether 30 days had elapsed. But again, I think that really wasn't an issue in dispute in the case. I would cite the court to the cases of McDaniel versus Tucker, 520 Southwest 2nd, 543, a 1975 case out of the Court of Appeals of Corpus Christi, no writ, and the case of Royalex versus AFCO, 559 Southwest 2nd, 833, out of the 14th District Court of Appeals in Houston, 1977, again, no writ. In that case, they held that there was no need for a jury issue on the presentment and the non-performance when it's not in dispute or when it is conclusive. And I think that's what happened in this case. The Ellis versus Waldron case, that is distinguishable by the fact that the case was about whether a fellow had to exercise a right of first refusal or not. It was more or less a declaratory judgment case. It wasn't an allegation of breach of contract. And in that case, the court held that there can be no pleading or proof of presentment because there was not a breach of contract claim really before the court, and therefore attorney's fees were not allowed. In this case, the breach had occurred. Notice was not given. The bank's duty was breached, and it was the breach of that duty which put us in court. When we came to the bank, we presented the money. At that point, we want the boat. We don't want notice. And that is all we could do in this context. And I think that constitutes a fair presentment. In summary, I think the court has an opportunity to write some law in an area where there is not too much law, the non-deficiency use of Section 9.507. The Court of Appeals stated that they felt that it was good policy to allow attorney's fees under 9.507, citing the cost of litigation and so forth. We're not here asking that attorney's fees awarded because we want the court's sympathy, because a lot of time was incurred in the case, but simply to recognize the fact that attorney's fees were a necessity and it was a loss incurred by the bank.
Are you continuing here, again, this double recovery on that point, that attorney's fees as actual loss should be given, and also the 10% of the principal debt, et cetera, on a statutory minimum should also be given. But doesn't that come into play only if there is no actual law? That's what got me a little confused.
In my opinion, I think, yes, there can be this sort of cumulative recovery under both clauses for a loss such as attorney's fees. I don't think you could have a cumulative recovery for the loss of the deficiency and the statutory penalties. But attorney's fees are not something in the mathematics of the transaction between creditor and debtor. You're not rewarding the debtor in any way. You're simply making him whole, giving him the benefit of his bargain.
Wouldn't that require us to add a little bit to the statute itself to find that?
It would require you to construe the statute. I'll admit that.
And not strictly.
No, I will concede that also. I wish I could say, yes, it's clear-cut. I mean, it's not clear-cut, and I think that's why we're down here today on this case.
Any form of actual damage is simply to make the party whole.
That is correct. That is correct.
I don't have the transcript for me, so I don't know how the issue was submitted. But were the attorney's fees issues just submitted as you submit 2226 attorney's fees, or was there any issue that required whether or not the attorney's fees constituted a loss as a result of the bank's conduct?
No, sir.
There was not?
No. That's all. Thank you, counsel.
We will hear rebuttal time on the petition.
Let me direct the court's attention on the subject of disposition. In arriving at support for my position that it has an obvious meaning of transfer of title or ownership, call the court's attention to section 9.504D that provides that when collateral is disposed of by a secured party after default, the disposition transfers to the purchaser for value all of the debtor's rights therein, and so forth. Now, we don't have a case here dealing with a purchaser for value, perhaps, but in any event, that's the only part of this code that I'm remember, at least, that dealt with the questioning or speaking on this subject of disposition. Both Black and Webster referred to this as an act of disposing and alienating ownership. And it's our contention that this then has an obvious meaning of a transfer of title. Now,
when the Court of Appeals or this court writes an opinion and says we have disposed of that point, what does disposition mean in that respect?
Well, when the court speaks, I bow to it. I basically say have no further argument, but I try to figure out exactly what the court does mean, perhaps. But mention was made earlier about the bank having this boat for 14 months. That I would call the court's attention is not correct. Mr. Marat R. Mascapper Allen had in 14 months, excuse me. The respondent takes a position that, and rightly so, as far as the evidence was concerned, he sequestrated the property. And it was in the possession of the sheriff most of this time as a result of his conduct. No demand, incidentally, there's no showing in the record of any demand whatever having been made upon the bank to assist Mr. Gex in reclaiming this. He was advised of the situation the day that he paid the balance of the note out there. Now, Mr. Glassman said that something about not having ever refunded the $508 that was paid to the bank, admittedly, by Ms. Capriellen. This was credited on the note. And so Mr. Gex only paid the balance of it. He's the one that got the benefit of it as far as reducing his notes concerned. And there's no evidence of him ever having paid the $500 or anything or any demand being made by the bank to pay again. So there's certainly no enhancement or enrichment on the part of the bank in this case. They simply collected their note and collected the repossession fees that they had incurred, which we submit they were entitled to. Now, with reference to the attorney's fee thing, in the trial court, the claims attorney's fees was made solely on the basis of 2226. No mention made of any reliance on section 9.507A. It's our position there that there was no proof of any contract between the parties that the bank would pay attorney's fees. We say that that's necessary to recovery under 2226. There's no consequently, I mean, it was at that particular time. So then, after the trial, for the first time, counsel raised the point that, well, it could also be upheld under 9.507A. And, of course, this leads to this double recovery section we're talking about. It simply implies that that section of the code authorizes attorney's fees. And we submit that it does not. Earlier, I inadvertently omitted my last point, which I think is, as far as Mr. Glassman's concerned, he has no dispute with. But this was a case, as I mentioned, settled with Ms. Catherine Allen. All of this was filed with the Court of Appeals. They approved it. And then nevertheless turned around and awarded a judgment in her favor for Ms. Catherine Allen.
Didn't amount to a clerical error by the Court of Appeals.
It perhaps is, Your Honor, but...
we can correct that in judgment without having to write on that.
That point, I agree with you. I had no serious worry about it because I got released, but be that as it may, I felt like it was something that shouldn't have been done, and since they had these other complaints, I just inserted that one as well. Unless the court has some further question, I'll conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Okay.